Stories, Threads, and Magic from the Life of Dennis C. Merritt, Part 5. The Interview, 1981, Cambridge. Back in the 1980s, I started working for the Computer Corporation of America, CCA. It was a grandiose name for a relatively small company of around 30 people in Cambridge, Mass. These were some of the biggest brains I've ever worked with and did some amazing work under contract to the Department of Defense's Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA. They were involved in the creation of ARPANET, which was the precursor to the Internet. They developed one of the first electronic mail systems. And the project I was hired to work on, Model 204, was a database created in the 1970s that provided query capabilities to the massive amounts of surveillance data being collected by the National Security Agency, NSA. At the time, few people even knew NSA existed. There was a popular spy novel written in the 1970s, which was one of the first to even mention the existence of the NSA. In it, with a science fiction sort of flair, the book had NSA operatives using a then unheard of ability to ask English-like questions of the massive NSA computers, learning about various evildoers' whereabouts and the like. It wasn't science fiction. It was Model 204. By the 1980s, software was just becoming something that could be sold, and CCA wanted to get into it. They took two of their projects and turned them into commercial products. This was software running on the large corporate mainframe computers of the day and costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was a long sales cycle and took dedicated salespeople to get paying customers. One product was Comet, the first electronic mail system that could be used for inter-office communication. CCA itself, of course, was one of the first users of electronic mail, and that could be a whole other story. Flame wars erupted about company issues like whether there should be soda machines in the break room or parking should be paid for. Like, why should drivers be subsidized when those taking the subway weren't? Normally mild individuals sitting quietly at their desks were typing vitriol and hurling insults they would never say in person. These were people who had worked together for years, just up and down the hall from each other. Amazing. The other product was Model 204, as the market for commercial mainframe databases was beginning to grow. I was doing tech support for this new venture. I had originally been hired to do development, but wow, I was in over my head with these people. That's another story. Although here's a clue. I was an average sort of player of the Asian strategic game Go at the Massachusetts Go Club. The key developer of Model 204, on the other hand, was one of the strongest Go players in America. So I wound up doing tech support, which meant getting some idea of how the initial customers were using the system. Now, the Model 204 group wanted to expand its sales to the West Coast and was looking to hire someone to open an office in California. We were flying people in to interview for that job. Normally, the head of the Model 204 group, or its one salesperson, would take an interviewee around, but both were out of town when this one fellow from San Francisco showed up. I was given the job of shepherding him around to the various people who would interview him for the job. You might guess that CCA was heavy on technical talent, but pretty naive when it came to things like sales and marketing. That would be correct. We thought we needed some help with the interview, and there was a newly hired VP of sales, Bob Rhoda, in the Comet group who agreed to be one of the people interviewing this guy. After all the interviews, it was then my job to go around and see what people thought. I knew as much about what it would take to open a sales office as the other technical people. We just kind of had vague sorts of impressions and kind of sort of like this or didn't like that, but really, we didn't know what we were doing. Then I went in to see what Bob Rhoda thought. Now, he was a relatively new hire and hired because he did know about sales and business. Bob began to give me his impressions of the guy. He was able to detail the various strengths a salesperson should have and how on each of those points this guy would rank, whether he'd be good at growing a territory or closing sales or prospecting or... After that, he then said, it depends on whether you want this guy to sell or to create an office and grow it. For that, you need different skills, and here's how he would stack up for that. Bob had this guy totally dissected and laid out on his mental spreadsheet. His opinion, after analyzing all that, was this guy wouldn't be a good fit and probably wouldn't be able to do what we needed in California. I was blown away. I had never heard anyone so meticulously break down and analyze a person and a job. I didn't know Bob, and I realized I was way over my head, and, as I tend to do, I tried to use humor to cover my discomfort. I told him I agreed with him, but my reason was I didn't like those trendy, zip-up-the-side dress boots he was wearing. Bob Rota just stared at me, then cracked up laughing, and when he stopped said, "Oh, yes, that was it for me, too." Epilogue. Bob was promoted to head Model 204 sales, as well as Comet, and sent me out to California to open that office. What if he could shoot the moon? 2010, Norfolk, Virginia. When I was growing up, my parents and I would often play the card game Hearts. Those were fun times for our small family. It's no surprise, then, that as a grandparent, I'd get our larger family around the table to play Hearts. Any combination of my son, daughter, spouses, and three grandchildren might be playing. Do you know how to play Hearts? It's a trick-taking game where, unlike most such games, you don't want to take tricks. For each trick you take with a heart in it, you get one bad point. If you take a trick with the Queen of Spades, you get 13 bad points. So you want to avoid taking those tricks. This means that you try to play your cards so you dump hearts and/or the dreaded queen on the other players whenever you can. It's kind of a nasty game that way, with each player trying to figure out how to give bad points to the opponents. But what if you could capture all 13 hearts and the Queen of Spades? Then, instead of getting 26 bad points, you would get 26 good points. That's called shooting the moon. Do you see the emotional roller coaster this can create? Everyone gleefully dumping hearts and/or the queen on one hapless player, and then gradually realizing that that player is shooting the moon, and all those bad points will become good points. Well, it takes a good hand and skill at cards to be able to shoot the moon. It turns out my dad had that skill at cards. When he was in the Navy in the Pacific during World War II, he made a lot of money in the ship's card games. But then he said he lost it all in the dice games. Anyway, so when he'd play hearts with my mom and me, he would often shoot the moon. He did it so often, my mother and I would each deliberately take heart tricks early on to try to stop him. Fast forward to a family game with me, the grandpa, various adults, and the three grandboys. The youngest was Miguel, at the time barely old enough to hold and play the cards. He had no real idea of the rules or purpose of the game, but enjoyed putting cards on the table as the whole family played. I was sitting between Miguel and his father, my son, Michael. I asked Michael if he thought I should help Miguel. He said he thought it best to just let Miguel play whatever cards he felt like and consider him a sort of random factor wild card in the game. I agreed that was a good and fun plan. Except, while helping him organize his hand, I'd seen his cards. I slipped a note to Michael so the others wouldn't see, saying, "But what if he could shoot the moon?" Ignoring Michael's advice, I started showing Miguel which cards to play and when. Sure enough, he won the Queen of Spades and was well on his way to collecting all the hearts. There was nothing any of the other players could do to stop him. It got down to the last two tricks, and he, with my guidance, was only one heart away from shooting the moon. It was then that I realized I'm not my father. I'd miscalculated. There was no way for Miguel to get that last heart. And why? Because I had left myself in a position where I had no choice other than to be the one to take that last heart trick. So instead of 26 good points, Miguel got 25 bad points, and I got one. Well, Miguel didn't really care. He just enjoyed playing. But Michael laughed and laughed and noted that I was the worst grandpa ever. Breast cancer. 1995, Ohio. AI. First, a little background on artificial intelligence, AI. Then and now. Today, there are amazing things happening every day with AI. So what is AI software? AI software has two parts. One is an encoding of the knowledge the software is supposed to be intelligent about. The other is a means to query that knowledge with specific questions. Why was AI hard? While computers are very good at representing data and procedures, knowledge is fuzzier, and encoding it has been a difficult research problem since Alan Turing, one of the founders of computer science, first pondered it in the 1940s. Today's AIs are amazing because the problem of representing knowledge has been solved with massive software simulations of the neural networks of a human brain. What's more, these neural networks can learn without the need of humans to encode the knowledge. Wow, scary. But AI was real back in the day as well. In the mid-1980s, it came out of academic research laboratories with a variety of techniques and tools developers could use to handcraft knowledge into software applications. We created our small company, AMSI, based on those developments, providing tools and services for building knowledge-based, that is, AI applications. Not to brag too much, but I used our tools to create what was maybe the first program that could solve Rubik's Cube, crafting into code the knowledge of speed cubers. Sigh, the new AI made my skills obsolete, but I have since retired, so all is good. In the mid-1990s, the internet was emerging, and to capitalize on that, we developed a tool for programmers to use to create online knowledge-based applications. We called it Webbles, for the Web Logic Server, and offered it for sale for $99 and thought we would get rich. We advertised in all the magazines programmers read, and we waited for inquiries and sales to start pouring in. But we only got one, just one, from a colonel in the Army, Dr. Fred Hagee, who was in charge of breast cancer research during the Clinton years. That in itself is an interesting story about politics and research. Why the Army? But I won't stray too far from the main point. Breast cancer. In those days, breast cancer was fatal about 50% of the time, and the nature of the disease was such that someone recently diagnosed had to make life or death decisions about the treatment with little understanding of the options and how they applied to her particular case. For example, just remove the lump, a lumpectomy, or the whole breast, mastectomy. Fred's idea was to hire us to use our new tool to create a website that women who were diagnosed with breast cancer could use to better understand their options. It would filter through the maze of knowledge available and just focus on what was pertinent for their particular diagnosis, such as the size of the tumor. And how was the knowledge encoded? Sort of like this, in rules. Here's a simple example. If lump size greater than 4 centimeters, then mastectomy. If lump size less than 2 centimeters, then lumpectomy. The patient entered what she knew of her diagnosis, such as the lump size, into the system, and it would find the pertinent bits of knowledge and produce a customized report explaining what she needed to know. The system was a huge success, and thousands of women used it to guide them through the complexity of cancer treatment. It got us an award from the Smithsonian and an article in the Washington Post that said it was the only application worth anything on the internet. That was 1995. But that's not what this story is about. Psychology. In our research for the system, we got to talk to the cancer practitioners at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Breast cancer treatment involves 7 types of doctors, including oncologists, radiologists, and surgeons. The last of the 7 was a psychologist. There we were, awash in all this medical technology, and here's what the psychologist said. He said that, in his experience, women with breast cancer typically fit one particular psychological profile. They were women who had given up their own lives in the nurturing support of others. Maybe their husbands, maybe their children, but they had sacrificed themselves for others. He said that those women who were able to change survived, and those that didn't died. We asked him if he told the women this. He said no, no one wants to hear that. But instead, he would try to steer women in a healthy direction. Regrettably, it wasn't in our system either. Rock climbing. Fast forward a decade or so, and I'm at a rock climbing area hanging out with some climbers, one of whom I had just met. I was sitting with him at the base of a climb, waiting our turn, and we got to talking. I'd asked what he did, and it turns out he was a cancer research doctor working at Duke University. He proceeded to tell me in flat and boring tones about the technical aspects of the research he did. I was curious what someone immersed in that medical technology would think of the story of the psychologist I just told. So I told it to him and asked his opinion. His whole demeanor changed. He sat up straight, got very excited, and said, "Yes, yes, that's it, exactly." And he went on to say his wife was working in just that area and told of the relationships between mind and disease that she was witnessing. Epilogue to Walter Reed interviews. Based on our research and working with Sabrina, who was our medical expert, we did write that award-winning AI software that guided people through the mechanistic world of medical cancer cure technology. But we also wrote a book, Reflection, that explored the whole mystical, magical nature of the connections between mind, body, and it all. First Man Extra, 2018, Kennedy Space Center. I'd always said I wanted to be an extra in a movie, to be able to say that at so many minutes into such and such a movie, it was me walking across the street. When we were living near the Florida Space Coast, I got my chance. First Man, a movie about Neil Armstrong's trip to the moon, was shooting a scene at the Kennedy Space Center. They were looking for men to be boring, old, geeky, white guy NASA executives. I could do that. I was amazed by the amount of energy and attention to detail that went into what would only be a few seconds of the final movie. They were shooting the scene where the astronauts were leaving the Space Center for a shuttle van to take them to the rocket. We had a photo from 1969 of them leaving the building, getting ready to go into the van. This is what they used to set the scene. I was to be a NASA executive at the top of the stairs as they walked by. We must have shot that scene 20 or 30 times. It took most of a day. One poor extra was playing a photographer who was kneeling in the picture. He kept trying to get a more comfortable position, and they kept telling him, "No, look at the picture. You need to be kneeling with your arm up, like so." The other extra people were NASA techs, security people, and a gaggle of photographers. It was strange that, even though none of us knew each other, we tended to group by the social strata of our roles. I hung out with the other executives. We had gotten into our suits and haircuts a few days earlier. I didn't find out until afterwards that the person in charge of costumes was Mary Zofries, who had been nominated for an Academy Award for her work on La La Land and had worked on many Coen Brothers movies, including Fargo. She clearly enjoyed her work, taking pride in the period authenticity she brought to the movies. I was glad to have had those few moments with her as she picked out my suit and tie and fitted me in them. She insisted we wear suspenders. Why? Because nobody today is willing to hitch their pants up to the height they were worn then, so we had suspenders under our jackets to hold our trousers to the correct period height. In the picture, one of the execs was by a post after the astronauts had come down. I was hoping to have that position, and I was for a little bit. But James Hansen, the author of the book on which the film is based, wanted a cameo in the film, and he took my spot. Before I wound up on the ramp, they moved me behind him, which was interesting because I got to talk to him for a little while. He made the observation that we didn't have the technology to fake a moon landing back in 1969, but we do now. He said the images in the movie are amazing and were mostly shot with physical models rather than computer graphics in Atlanta. Well, I was out of sight behind the wall in the final movie, which is just as well, because if I had been in it, I would have wanted to see it more than once, and it really wasn't a very good movie. No sour grapes here. In summary, it was a very long, boring day, but I'm glad to have had a small part. It was especially fun because in 1969, I was actually working on Apollo. For those who don't remember, The Onion, a satirical newspaper, told the story as it should have been told. The headline in their paper was, "Holy shit, man walks on fucking moon." And the lead story starts out, Neil Armstrong's historic first words on the moon. "Holy living fuck, we're on the goddamn moon." Nelson's Adventure, 2022, Shelburne Falls. Nelson, our dog, as he does many times a day, went down the back deck steps for a peaceful wander around the yard, sniffing and doing his business. But on this day, as never before, he started howling, running in circles, and this old dog, who has difficulty walking, took off down the street at a full sprint, cut between two houses, and disappeared from sight. Really disappeared. Searching for him, there was no sign. People about had not seen him, and a posting to a local Facebook group had many people looking for him, with no luck. What had happened, it turns out, was he had gone to a small stream near the houses, probably to get relief from whatever had gotten to him. That stream goes into a culvert that goes under the streets and yards and empties, after about two blocks, into the river running through our town. Whether by choice or the current, it had gone through the culvert and gotten stuck where it empties out above the river. Nobody on our side of the river could have seen him, which is how he so totally disappeared. Two people on the other side of the river happened to look across and notice him. They came over to our side, wrestled him out of the culvert, and saw that he made it home. Nelson probably would have died there had they not seen him and come to help. What had happened to him? There was no smell of a skunk, no porcupine quills, nothing to indicate anything had thrown him into such a state. Maybe some yellow jackets? But it was January, and he had been wandering the yard for years without incident. No idea what happened. Connections. Whatever the reason, these events were uncannily entwined with emotions that had been building within me. The emotions didn't cause the events, nor the events cause the emotions, but they were connected in a synchronicity sort of way. Nancy, my wife, and Nelson's rightful owner, was in Florida for a few months, visiting family and avoiding the cold. I was staying in our home in Massachusetts, taking care of Nelson, who really was more our dog, and using the quiet time to work on my writing while sitting by the wood stove. Nelson wasn't much trouble, except he was getting older, having passed my 77 human years in his dog years. The biggest hassle was walks. I used to really enjoy taking him off leash and watching him bound through the woods, and didn't mind, as he got older, simply taking him around the neighborhood. But he'd gotten where he often would refuse to walk, and if we did start out, would stop and wouldn't go either this way or that. It was annoying. As far as doing his business, that wouldn't have been too much of a problem if I could have done what we'd always done. Our house is on a slope, with the front door at street level and the back opening on a deck with stairs down to the yard. We'd let him out on the deck, he'd go down the steps, wander around the yard, and then come up the steps and back in without leaving the yard. But his legs were starting to go, and he couldn't make it up the steps anymore. Nelson came up with a solution. He'd go down the back steps, somewhat shakily, wander about as much as he liked, and then take the easier route up the slope on the side of the house. Then he'd circle around on the sidewalk, come to the front door, and patiently wait to come in without even thinking of going in the street. What a good dog. I'd keep a dog biscuit in my hand so I wouldn't forget to periodically check the front door after letting him out. We did this maybe 5 or 6 times a day whenever he was pacing about the house. It worked great. But now the first major snowstorm was coming, and all I could think of was what a pain. I won't be able to let him out back as the steps will be snowy and, even if cleared, icy. And there isn't much front yard between the house and the street. He's obstinate about walks, yet paces about, and I am trying to write. I was working myself into quite an agitated state. Okay, maybe unjustly. Maybe I was being a bit of a jerk. But the key point for this story is, no matter what the reason, that was how I was feeling. It was in that state of mind that I let him out for what I knew would be his last trip around the yard before the snow started. And it was in that state of mind that I heard him start to howl. And it was in that state of mind that I saw him tearing down the street. I knew my issues caring for Nelson were over. He was gone, I sensed, maybe forever. I didn't feel good thinking that, but that's what I was thinking. I felt guilty, as if it was, and maybe it was, my fault had run away. As I drove around looking for him, checking the small streets, the ones with traffic, there was absolutely no sign. I began to feel he really might be gone forever. I began to feel worse about how I'd felt, and began to despair that he might not come back, as I was fond of him, and he was a good dog. It was as that second state of mind was settling in that I got the call that he was found and safely home. So there's the magic connections. My resentment and his disappearance. My grief and his rescue. No causal connection, but my feelings and the events were perfectly reflected in each other as they unfolded that day. Epilogue. The next morning, I shoveled the snow, and when Nelson woke up, put on my jacket, grabbed the leash, and together we went out the front door. No agenda, no walk, just him going where he wants with me following. Found a good spot to pee, then sniffed around a bit, wandered through the snow and a little ways up the sidewalk, found a good spot to poo, and then headed back. It was just fine, hanging out with him wherever he wanted to go on a snowy winter day. My fretting had been for naught. And his sudden disappearance and recovery got me connecting more with the good Nelson vibes rather than the irksome ones. The whole very strange incident led us to a more harmonious place, and I got some writing done. Nelson has since passed on. Fortuitous Dog Bite, 2022, Shelburne Falls. Some medical turmoil in my life was recently relieved by voices in my head that led me to a dog that bit me on my rump. I say voices, But unlike that incident on my bike 50 years ago, where the voice was almost audible, these weren't so clear in diction, but were perfectly clear in intent. They were from somewhere other than my rational mind and urged me to take steps other than what I'd planned. My medical turmoil. I try to avoid our healthcare system as much as I can, preferring if at all possible to keep myself healthy with diet, exercise, good thoughts, and the like. It's not like I don't believe in all the amazing medical technology we have, but rather don't trust the profit-oriented system we have of delivering that technology to people. Nor do I fully accept the body as a machine model of our medical technology, and do think there is a powerful mental aspect to our health. However, I'm not a fanatic, and did have a doctor and used him when needed for some small thing or another. Except a bigger thing started to happen. My heart, with even slight exercise, such as my daily walks, would sometimes jump to double time from a normal 60 to 70 beats per minute to 120 to 140. If I stopped, took a deep breath, it would soon slow down, but it was worrisome. Well, I'm not going to go into the details, but my doctor at the time provided some very unsettling care looking into this, making me more and more certain I didn't want anything to do with our medical system. I had made earlier some attempts to find another doctor, but due to various issues with local practices closing, hospital budgets, staffing, whatever, there were no general practitioners, GPs, taking new patients. So I decided to take myself to a higher spiritual plane and not worry about it, to accept whatever my karma delivers, to open myself to the universe and proceed on my normal walks. And I walked with that sense of inner peace and, wait, is that my heart again? I stopped and took my pulse. Okay, relax, it's normal again. And resuming my peaceful walk and, wait, is it going again? I was compulsively checking my pulse every few minutes as I walked. It seemed I wasn't on as high a spiritual plane as I thought. Having convinced Nancy, my wife, not to push me into the medical system, I confided in a nurse friend who, immediately, pushed me to drop my current doctor, she knew of him, and find a good GP to help me get to the bottom of this. But she didn't know of any who were taking new patients. Sigh, so there I was, not wanting to get deeper into the medical system, but knowing I had to, and sensing how difficult it would be to even find someone taking new patients, let alone one who was reasonably good and remotely close to where we lived. Tomorrow, I'll start looking in earnest. I woke up the next morning with a need to act weighing heavy on me. I did nothing. I knew I had to start looking, but didn't. I knew I needed a doctor, but there were none to be found. It got to be late in the afternoon, and I'd still done nothing. The voices. Distracted by it all, I decided to go on my walk and get out before it started to get dark. That's when I first was aware of the voice. My room was a bit cluttered, and it told me to make my bed. Huh? I had to get out. It said I didn't have to clean up more, just do that one task for that amount of time before starting. I was in a distressed state, and I didn't argue. I made the bed and then started out on my walk. Let me tell you about my walk. I always go out the front door and head north, walking to the edge of our village. From there, sometimes I would loop around the village clockwise, or loop around our river counterclockwise, or continue straight for a circuit around a local cemetery, always starting north and one of those three. The voice said, "Go south." Huh? I never start to the south. It strongly suggested I go south. Well, okay, I might do that for a change, and I could go over the iron bridge downtown and loop up by the old Lamson factory and head towards Cricket Field. So I did. When I got to Cricket Field, that voice told me to sit on a bench in the gazebo there. Note that I never stop and sit on my walks. But I did, and sat for a little while until it was clear it was time to get up and head home. The dog. Now, At one point on the walk back, I would be walking along a sidewalk between a road and the river, with some plantings at some parts. As I was approaching that area, I saw a young, to me, family headed towards me, a man, his wife, a stroller, and two rather rambunctious dogs. For most of that section of the sidewalk, there was room between the sidewalk and river for them to give me a wide berth with the dogs. But we met precisely where a tree forced us to squeeze closer in order to pass. He was wrestling the dogs between the stroller and the tree as I approached, staying on the sidewalk. After I just passed them, I felt the teeth of one of the dogs biting me on the rump. "Goddamn fucking A, your dog just bit me." I was really pissed. They apologized. I'm thinking, great, do we need to check for rabies and whatever? He, the man, said his dogs were vaccinated, but it wouldn't be a problem if the bite hadn't broken the skin. I was still pretty angry and couldn't see my own butt, but I do like to settle things quickly and don't like our legal system any better than our healthcare system. So I made him an offer. I would go around behind a car with him, show him my butt, and he'd tell me if it broke the skin. Fair enough, and he told me it wasn't a problem because, wait for it, he was a doctor. The doctor. Well, the skin wasn't broken. He offered to give me his contact information. I was still pissed his dog bit me, and it stung some, but not too much, and they seemed nice people, so I was fine with letting it drop. It did register that he was a doctor, but I just thought he was one of those specialists and not one of interest to me. I went on my way. How about that? I was stressed about finding a doctor, heard voices that led me directly to an interaction with a doctor, and I still didn't get it. More magic was needed. Now, Matt is a neighbor and a professional dog walker. We're friendly, but never actually spend any time talking. But on that walk back, on that particular day, I wound up on the same street with him going the same way. I said, "Matt, you won't believe what just happened to me." And I told him about the dog bite. He asked about the dog. I described it. And it turns out he knew the dog and the couple and walked their dogs for them sometimes. He said he's a primary care doctor and a good one with a new and growing practice. Well, I'll be. I figured it was destined he should be my doctor, so I looked him up, sent him a letter with his story in it, and asked if he would accept me as a patient. He said yes. If the voices hadn't gotten me on a different walk and induced those delays, it wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have been at that exact narrow spot where the dog could have a nip at me. And what a surgically precise nip it was. Enough to hurt and piss me off, but not enough to puncture either my skin or my jeans. What a wonderfully timed, beneficial incident. The dog knew better than both of us that I had a rump that needed to be bitten just that hard at just that moment. Epilogue. This doctor was perfect for me. Wanted to be in primary care to help people get the care they need. This is not where the money is in medicine. He understood perfectly my desire to have as little health care as possible, and also my desire to have a doctor as an advisor, letting me know my options, not telling me what to do, but outlining my choices. He had a bunch of tests done, we did some thinking, and it turns out I might have triggered the heart issues when I decided to eliminate the thyroid medicine I was taking, so I started taking it again, and the number of incidents of a racing heart have greatly diminished. Who knows how my health will progress and our healthcare system evolve, but I feel I have at least one good doctor to provide a bridge between the two for me.